my happy home to see what I could find out. I left my folk and friends with the aim to clear my mind out. Well, I hit the rowdy road, many kinds I met there. Many stories told me all of the way to get there. Ooh. So on and on I go, the seconds tick, the time out. There's so much left to know when I'm on the road to find out.
Welcome to Unspun, an experiment in truth-telling on KKRN 88.5 FM. I'm your host, Doug Bennett. Unspun tries to unravel the hype and illusions of corporate media through in-depth interviews with truth-tellers, advocates, and activists from around the world. We are streaming live on the internet. Go to kkrn.org and click on the Listen button. Unspun is a call-in show. We invite questions and comments from our listeners. Our number in the studio is 530-337-1885, 530-337-1885. You can also send me an email if you'd like to at unspun@kkrn.org, pretty much like it sounds, or you can follow me on Twitter at DougBennett15. Our guest today is Dmitry Orlov. Dmitry Orlov is the author of Reinventing Collapse, the Soviet Example, and American Prospects, The Five Stages of Collapse, Survivor's Toolkits, and the forthcoming Shrinking the Technosphere. Dmitry Orlov was born in Russia. He moved to the U.S. while a teenager and has traveled back repeatedly to observe the Soviet collapse during the late 80s and the mid-90s. He is an engineer who has worked in many fields, including high-energy physics research, e-commerce, and internet security. For the past 5 years, he has been experimenting with off-grid living and renewable energy by giving up the house and the car. Instead, he has been living on a sailboat, sailing it up and down the eastern seaboard and commuting by bicycle. Dmitry believes that given appropriate technology, we can greatly reduce personal resource consumption while remaining perfectly civilized. His blog at Club Orlov, it's http://cluborlov.blogspot.com, is full of thought-provoking articles dealing with the collapse of Western civilization, financial analyses, and possible solutions to the problems of the U.S. imperial overreach, climate change, and social degradation in the modern world. One of his latest articles is entitled A Russian Warning. Another is The Money Cult. Well, let's welcome our guest, Dmitry Orlov. Welcome to Unspun and the Experiment of Truth-Telling.
Thank you for having me on your show.
It's truly a privilege. You've done a lot of work, research, and given a lot of thought to important questions. I think that many people have, not only Americans, but around the world. And your latest article was really kind of startling. It was the reason I got in contact with you and asked you to be on. The title is A Russian Warning. And you and your co-authors paint a pretty dire picture of a scenario where Russia is forced to retaliate against Western aggression, and even understanding the probable outcome. Why do you think U.S. and NATO allies are demonizing Russia and poking the Russian bear with a sharp stick?
Well, there are two parts to it. One is that there's this big military alliance called NATO, North Atlantic Treaty Alliance, which, since the collapse of the Soviet Union, has no reason to exist. It has done some absolutely futile things in Afghanistan. It bombed Serbia. It is now conducting all kinds of military maneuvers in the Baltic, in the Black Sea, and in the Baltic states, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania. Absolutely pointless activity. And what they're doing is trying to convince themselves, I suppose, that Russia poses an existential threat in order to justify defense spending. It is basically an extortion racket at this point. It has nothing to do with defense. So that's one half of the reason. The other half of the reason is that a terrible thing has happened to the foreign policy establishment in the United States. Under George Bush Sr., these people called the neoconservatives have sort of snuck into the White House basement. George Bush Sr. called them the crazies in the basement. He didn't really have them participate that much in foreign policy decisions. He was knowledgeable and his own man. But under Clinton, they pretty much took over. And now they're inside Hillary Clinton's brain, definitely. They're like a brain parasite. And they've completely infested the U.S. State Department. And these people are insane. They believe that the United States can take over the entire world. And they're pushing this program of world domination, imperial domination, even though everything they have tried, all of these wars, all of these countries they've destroyed, like Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, now Syria, Yemen, the Ukraine, all of these are complete fiascos, military fiascos and strategic geopolitical fiascos. And so that's where we stand now is, you know, we have this useless organization, military organization, that all it does is try to justify military spending. And then we have a completely insane bunch of people running the foreign policy establishment of the United States. And if Hillary gets in, they're going to provoke a much larger military confrontation, probably leading to a world war.
And as you point out, that's pretty insane because a world war, starting a war, well, it wouldn't last very long probably, right? We're talking about nuclear holocaust, aren't we?
Yes, we're talking about 30 minutes before much of the U.S. population has been destroyed and probably a fair number of Russians dead too.
And the world wouldn't look too pretty after that. I'm assuming, and, you know, I was in the military and in intelligence for a while, and actually knew a lot about Russian armaments and stuff back in the 60s. But the message is really we would be targeting, as well as they would be targeting, not only communication centers, but nuclear power plants. I mean, all types of things, unheard of, unleashed catastrophe, really.
Yes, it's a completely catastrophic scenario. It is in nobody's interest. Absolutely nobody's.
And also, you know, I looked into this a while back. I've done a few studies of American history, and I was looking back at the creation of NATO. You bring up NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, and there's a long history there of demonizing and alienating Russia, is there not?
Well, yes, definitely. There was an interlude right after World War II, which was won by Russia, you know, the U.S. only participated marginally at the very end after it was a foregone conclusion that Nazi Germany would be defeated. But they basically went for a big land grab and got half of Western Europe and the Soviet Union got the rest. And then they started menacing Russia. Churchill, who was a Russophobe, and had a very bigoted view of the world, gave his Iron Curtain speech, and then things went downhill from there, and the Cold War got started. The Cold War was very much preventable. It was instigated by the West. The Soviet Union was not interested in a Cold War. It was interested in reconstruction and constructive relationships with the West and with the United States. But that was not to happen.
Yeah, I was looking back and thinking about, of course, the Cold War was the formidable ages for me, you know, and growing up in the 60s in California and America. And it occurred to me later it was just a way for major corporations like GE and Lockheed and numerous other defense contractors to keep the cash flow going. It really had nothing to do with communist aggression, as far as I could see, even as a young man, that was pretty obvious to me.
Well, yes, the attitude towards war in the United States and in Russia could not be more different. The United States is continuously at war. There were only a few years when the country was not at war. And most of these wars are for profit. They're basically ways of continuing capitalist exploitation by other means. Whereas Russia is most of the time at peace, the wars are very intermittent, many decades apart. And it doesn't start wars, but it always wins them. So the saying is, Russia doesn't start wars, it finishes them.
And Russians, most Americans don't know this. Well, most Americans don't know history, let alone Russian history or any other history. Even they don't even know their own. Sorry, folks, but I think it's true. And but there were a tremendous number of Russians that lost their lives, and they're really accounted for most of the German losses also. Is that right?
Well, yes. The military losses on both sides were quite comparable. In terms of fighting ability, the Germans and the Russians were evenly matched. But there was a tremendous loss of life because of all the people who starved to death, because of all the civilians who got shelled by the Germans, because of all the people who died in German concentration camps. Many people also succumbed of disease because of anti-sanitary conditions, because millions of people had to be evacuated. And there was really no way to provide for their health care. So those were the results of invasion, not the results of war itself.
How do the Russian people look at the Cold War? I don't think we ever hear that story. How do they regard that period in history?
With pride. Basically, when the United States nuked Japan, that's when the entire world realized that they're dealing with a completely psychopathic country that will stop at nothing. No other country has ever dropped nuclear bombs on another country, and I hope that no other country ever will, because it is such an atrocity. You cannot rationalize it away. But that's when everybody realized that, you know, somebody has to stand up to the United States, or it will nuke the planet. It will nuke the whole planet into submission. And that entity was the Soviet Union. It kept the United States at bay for a very long time. And now, unfortunately, it's Russia that has to do this again.
Yeah, let me remind our listeners, you're listening to Unspun, an experiment in truth-telling. I'm your host, Doug Bennett. With us today is Dmitry Orlov, author, futurist, and blogger at Club Orlov. We are talking about our collapsing economic, political, and environmental systems, along with the new Cold War that's been started by the Western powers, basically. And the other question, of course, is what can we do? What can be done? So we invite your questions and comments. Call in 337-1885, 530 area code 337-1885. The Cold War, and we thought we were, after the fall of the Berlin Wall and the collapse, basically, of the Russian Soviet, I shouldn't say Russian, I should Soviet Socialist Republic, it was looking like a new world. I know a lot of people were thinking, well, now we can move on to a more peaceful time, better relationships with Russia, and, growing democracy. What happened?
Well, the democratic experiment in Russia, conducted with a lot of American consultants' help, was a complete fiasco. It didn't work. It almost ruined the country, just as it doesn't work in most other places in the world, including the United States. And the Russians have a very bitter memory of that period of time, the 90s, and feel that it was a very shameful period. And it ruined a lot of lives, a lot of young lives, and they're glad to be over that.
And I'm not sure we're actually over. The Russian people might feel that way. They're over that hump, but we have these crazy you know, neocon-backed revolution, color revolutions, whatever you want to call them, you know, coups of governments like the Ukraine. And all of this is kind of targeted and enclosing on Russia to the point where and also economic sanctions against Russia, which I just totally don't get. I don't even know why the European nations even went along with that. But looking forward, I don't see a happy future for anybody, quite honestly. I see more wars, more corporate influence and corruption in governments around the world. So I'm surprised that you're probably more optimistic than I am in that sense. So how do you see that? You know, you talk a lot about collapse. I see a collapse, and maybe you could talk to that. And I know you talk about five stages of collapse, and maybe you could relate some of those ideas that you've brought up. And where are we in this scenario of collapse, corruption collapse? It seems like it's all happening at the same time. So where are we in that scenario?
Well, just to wrap up kind of the previous discussion of U.S. compared to Russia, Russia is very competently governed at this point, which is not something you can say about the United States. And if you look at all of these military adventures that the U.S. has been involved in since World War II, they're all tactical victories followed by strategic defeats. Every single one, Korea, Vietnam, Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, they were all just sort of shock and awe and go in there and blast the place apart. So you can call that a tactical victory. You aim to shoot up a place and you shoot it up, and there you go, the government falls. And then what follows is a strategic defeat, because there's absolutely no way to secure the peace or to improve the lives of the people in the place or anything like that. We see that in the Ukraine right now. So there was this coup, and now the country is in free fall. It's an economic collapse. Streams of refugees, same thing in Syria. And Russia does the opposite. They can deal with a tactical defeat now and again. They're a big, strong country. But what they really go for is the strategic victory. And so if you look at what Russia has been achieving, it's one strategic victory after another. Now, switching to the stages of collapse, I wrote a book on collapse, because people think about it and they think about the apocalypse, which is sort of this mythical thing, religious thing. It doesn't really relate to what actually happens. And so I broke down collapse into five stages so that each one could be talked about separately. The stages sometimes overlap. They don't happen as a cascade, but they can. So financial collapse is what usually happens first, because finance is all just sort of believing in the value of pieces of paper that are just pieces of paper. They're not necessarily valuable. And they, in the end, always turn out to be worthless. That has happened consistently over hundreds of years. The U.S. dollar has lost 98% of its value over its history. And it'll lose the remaining 2%. That is, definite, it's not even a prediction, it's a certainty. And so financial collapse happens first, and then the next thing that happens is commerce is at a standstill, because commerce depends on credit. So once finances collapse, there's no way to get credit, and international trade stops, supply lines are drained. All sorts of manufacturing and maintenance projects are suspended. And then the next thing that happens is tax revenue goes down to zero. And what follows is political collapse. So that kind of cascade, financial to commercial to political, is sort of programmed in. But there are all sorts of little coping mechanisms that people employ that work up to a point. So we've seen these coping mechanisms in the West, where financial collapse really happened in 2008. But it wasn't allowed to run its course. Instead, there were all these little ploys brought to bear, like quantitative easing, which was basically free money for banks, bank bailouts, ever lower interest rates, now stuck at zero for a long time. And in the rest of the world, interest rates have gone negative, which is a very interesting phenomenon. It's sort of financial collapse with the brakes on. But that's been happening too. As far as commercial collapse, well, it's hard to see because so much activity has been going into the energy industry because all of the good oil and gas reserves are gone. And so what's left is the dregs, which are eating up an incredible amount of technology and financial resources and industrial activity. But overall, the useful share of industrial activity has been falling more or less continuously since the financial collapse of 2008. There hasn't been any sort of recovery there at all. As far as political collapse, well, I mean, if you look at the presidential election cycle this time around.
Do I have to?
Well, you have to. Because the stakes are pretty much the existence of the world at this point, continued existence of a habitable planet. But it's a farce. You know, it's a complete and utter fiasco.
And I think many Americans would agree with you. And it was predictable. But we saw the same thing with Barack Obama. He was selling hope and change, and people bought into that. And so here we are almost 8 years later. And what do you think, Barack Obama's actions, his words are one thing, but the actions that happen under his administration are something else. And what do you think his legacy is going to be as the first black president of the United States?
Oh, he's not black. I mean, I live in a community full of black people. He's not black, okay? He's a cross between a Kenyan and an anthropologist. He's not a descendant of slaves. So calling him black just because of his skin tone, well, I could be black too if you put me in the sun long enough.
I agree, and I made that point on this show over the years a couple of times, but I took a lot of grief for making that statement. And but the honesty of it is he's not a descendant of black slaves. He's never experienced that. He grew up in Hawaii with his white grandparents and people of white privilege. So, yeah, but once again, the question, he's perceived as being the first black president. I'm sure that's going to be tacked on to part of his legacy. But what do you see? Has he really done anything for America or for the world? He got the Nobel Peace Prize just simply for showing up. How do you see his legacy?
He doesn't have one. On his watch, Libya got destroyed. On his watch, Syria got destroyed. He perpetuated the fiasco in Afghanistan. On his watch, Ukraine got destroyed. So he can take credit for destroying several countries. He can also take credit for moving the United States much closer to bankruptcy with his retarded Affordable Care Act, which is unaffordable and has nothing to do with health care. It's just a gigantic handout to private health insurance companies. What has he accomplished? What is there to say that he has a legacy? I mean, a criminal record is not a legacy.
Well, that's a pretty sad comment. So you think history is not going to shine on Mr. Obama's presidency any sort of praise, pretty much the other way, otherwise. And when you refer to him as a criminal, what specific criminal acts? And I know there are several or many. What are you referring to?
War crimes, attacking countries without sanction.
Listen, we have a caller, and I wanted to take this call. And before we lose our caller here, so. Mel, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning. Thank you, Mr. Orlov, for being on the show. There is an issue about Ukraine that the people of America never get to hear the other side or other sides of the story that pertain to Ukraine. And I'd appreciate it if you could maybe expand a little on what happened there the day that Malaysian MH17 flight was shot down over the eastern part of Ukraine. No one ever gets to hear about the side that the United States won't provide any kind of intelligence on what they saw happen over the Ukraine, even though Russia has provided such information. Intelligence agencies around the country have asked the United States to provide that information so that it could be clearer to Americans what actually happened there. But we never hear about the two Su-25 fighter jets that came up out of Ukraine and followed that aircraft. Maybe you could tell us what you think happened that day.
Okay.
Thanks. Yeah. I'll take your answer off the air.
Thank you, Mel.
Yeah, thank you, Mel. First of all, on Ukraine, there's a new documentary out by Oliver Stone. If you can watch it, please watch it. I haven't seen it yet. I just saw the trailer, and it looks very impressive. I think that is going to help clear the air on the whole issue, because he doesn't hide any of the truth. Now, as far as the MH17 disaster, I followed it for a while, and what it looks like to me is an attempt to, basically the Ukrainians shot down a passenger jet in order to pin the blame on these quote-unquote Russian rebels in eastern Ukraine. The whole thing is very murky, but what stands out is the refusal of everybody in the West to cooperate in investigating it. So far, every single effort to investigate it, first of all, excluded Malaysia and excluded Russia, which are basically the two countries that have a key interest in getting to the truth. And secondly, the whole investigation, as far as I can tell, has been a farce, very incompetently run, because it's a foregone conclusion that the blame has to somehow be pinned on Russia, or the whole operation just doesn't work. And that's where it stands. It is very unfortunate.
Let me do a bottom-of-the-hour break here. You're listening to Unspun on KKRN 88.5 FM, Bella Vista. KKRN is a community radio station and is funded by listeners and underwriters like yourselves. If you wish to support our efforts, go to our website at kkrn.org and click on the donate button. I only have one announcement to make, and it's KKRN's birthday party, and you're probably going to hear a few spots on the radio today if you're listening about it. But I wanted to let you know that we are having a birthday party, our fifth birthday, and it's going to be celebrated at Billy's Cafe on Highway 299 East. The address there is 30356 Highway 299 East. Their phone number is 337-6142. And that's going to be basically an open mic. We have the outdoors and indoors. We can be eating inside or outside and listening to music. And that's going to go on from 5 till 9 p.m. next Saturday, the 25th of June. So we invite you to attend our party. We're going to have a lot of fun. There are going to be a lot of people from KKRN there and a lot of people from the community. They have great food, and there'll be an open bar and music. So come on down and join us. And if you're a musician or a poet or anybody that would like to have a turn on the mic during the open mic session, please come down and join us and share your talents with us. So that's Saturday, June 25th, 5 to 9 p.m. at Billy's Cafe in Montgomery Creek, 30356 Highway 299 East. The number there again is 337-6142. Well, let's get back to our guest, Dmitry Orlov, author, futurist, blogger at Club Orlov. We're talking about U.S. foreign policy, collapsing economic, political, environmental systems, what we can do, what's gone on during the neocons' sway of influence during the Obama administration. If you'd like to join in the discussion, and I see we have another caller, you can call us here at 337-1885, 337-1885. Well, Dimitri, I'm going to take this next caller, since we've got one up, and see what he has to say. Randy, you're on the air.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
Hey, you know, considering that it takes it seemingly takes a lot of intelligence to keep together these global forces that are taking us to war and are destroying our biosphere, and right on even through the Republican Party, who stand in total collective denial of anthropogenic global warming. Do you think that that these people have a plan? I can only see where they're totally insane, or they have a plan to orchestrate chaos to even gain more control over the populace. What do you think of that notion?
Good question, Randy.
Well, it's really hard for me to say how much of it is cunning and how much of it is stupidity. If the end result is the same, then how can you tell the difference? So, you know, if you drop a brick on your foot, was that by design or was that an accident? If you're looking at accident-prone people who are basically busy ruining and dismantling their own country, you can say that yes, they're being shrewd and they're keeping ahead of the pack in ruining and dismantling their own country. Or you could say that they're being just as stupid as everybody else, maybe even more stupid. But there's really no basis on which to make that call, I would say. Whenever a big social system that was once big and prosperous and powerful is in a bad way and is becoming weaker and poor and more wretched, there's always this thing that happens where people kind of like people at the top dogs start eating each other, that's what I see happening in the U.S. is, you know, there's this very bad sort of competition going on where, you know, all of these people at the top want to be, you know, the last ones to stay afloat. And, it doesn't bode well for the rest of us. But I wouldn't say that, you know, this is the sign of superior intelligence. This is what always happens.
We've seen this in history. Every empire collapses. We know that. You've pointed that out in your work. And anybody that denies that America is an imperial force in the world, and that's the basic function of America these days, would not be paying attention. When I think about Randy's question there, what came to my mind is it just the American public seems to be sleeping through the whole thing? Is this like the lemmings or some sort of death wish? Do you think psychologically, collectively, there's something going on here?
Well, yes. There are two things going on. First of all, the people at the top at this point require denial. So there's very tight control of the media and of the messages that leak out. It's now one big system of very tight propaganda. It's not working because nobody's really paying attention anyway. The people who do care get their information through the internet, through social media, and through alternative websites, and the rest of the people really don't care at all. As far as denial, it's extremely important at this point, because the moment the people at the top admit that what is happening is actually happening, that this world dominance is kind of worse than futile and is largely over, that there isn't going to be any more economic growth, you know, there isn't going to be any more recovery. If they actually admit any of these things, basically their entire house of cards would collapse and they'd be out of a job. They would lose their privileged positions in society. So they will keep that suspension of disbelief going for as long as possible. As far as the rest of the people not paying attention, well, if you can't do anything about something, then why exactly should you pay attention to it? Why not just, like, go and play with your kids or something? You know, why not do something useful? Because paying attention to these people trying to eat each other is, you know, basically just bad for you.
Kind of counterproductive. Well, you know, you're pretty popular on the phones here, Dimitri. I got another call. I'm going to bring this caller on the air. Rocky, you're on the air.
Good morning, Doug.
Good morning.
You know, I want to say I really appreciate your show. It's you're doing a real public service with the information you provide. I just want to comment on the collective insanity of our military forces and their ability to do whatever comes onto the table. Like you, I was a Vietnam-era officer in an aviation unit in Vietnam, and it was very disturbing to me, the willingness of commissioned officers to carry out atrocities, basically for their career opportunities. Back then, advancement in the military was based on your medals and that, and it became a competitive thing to shed as much blood as you could under any circumstances. And that went right on up to the generals. I was under General Forsythe at the 1st Cav Division, and he had no qualms about shedding innocent blood. So if the public is concerned or places their faith in the military doing the right thing, I think they're sadly mistaken. I think that maybe a total collapse would be in the best interest of humanity. Anyway, that's about all I have to say, and I'll get off the air. Thank you.
And thanks, Rocky.
Well, thank you for that comment, Rocky. And, you know, you're right that, you know, Americans think of war as something that happens somewhere else. It's been a really, really long time since there was a serious war on American soil. And people in the South remember that. People in the North, again, think of it as a war that happened somewhere else. So there isn't really this appreciation for what comes around goes around, and then people are alarmed when various types of atrocities happen that involve Americans. But that's really what happened. As far as, you know, counting on the U.S. military to actually do something good, well, one positive thing that I might say about the U.S. military is that the commanders are not suicidal. They don't care about sacrificing their men. They don't care about collateral damage, about killing innocent civilians. None of that matters to them. They don't want to die themselves. But that actually might turn out to be key, because they will refuse to follow suicidal orders from their political masters, who are certifiably insane. And so I'm actually seeing that as one of the few grounds for optimism, in that, you know, we're not looking at nuclear annihilation because U.S. military officers will refuse to follow suicidal orders.
And the Russian response, I remember when the Soviet Union was going through its initial stages of collapse, and they were Russian troops were ordered to fire on some of their fellow countrymen, and they refused. So we have another example there of what you're talking about.
Well, yes, there were standoffs, there were absolutely ridiculous confrontations that happened under Yeltsin. Yeltsin was just an evil, evil man who used tanks to fire upon the, you know, government building full of officials in order to consolidate his power. That was one of the episodes that, you know, really ruined the politics of the country for close to a decade. But yes, you know, there is some understanding within most militaries that you do not achieve any sort of victory by slaughtering your own people.
There are a lot of people, I think, that would argue, especially the more nationalistic, militaristic people in America, which are a great number of, they would argue that, and coming back to the question of you know, poking the Russian bear, they would argue that we could do a first strike and we have the tactical nukes. I mean, I've heard all of this kind of propaganda. And what do you say to those people that there's some way to win a war with Russia?
Well, I mean, okay, so you win a war with Russia, but let's say Los Angeles, Dallas, Chicago, Atlanta, and New York are destroyed. Was that worth it?
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, if you're
in our country.
Yeah, if you're in the Midwest somewhere and you're still surviving the radiation fallout and nuclear winter hasn't taken you, I guess you would be able to say that that was worth it.
Well, I don't see a sane person making that argument.
Well, I was being somewhat facetious, but
yeah.
Yes, and so looking forward, even if that doesn't happen, if we don't have that nuclear event, the many people understand that we're going through some sort of collapse. It's obvious that socially America's in a shambles. Politically, it's teetering, you know, on what? Chaos. And so people are wondering, and you brought up coping mechanisms. So what is the easy answer? And maybe a quick answer, because we got another caller. What's the quick answer for people that want to survive those initial collapse? What do they do?
Well, get on the first thing you should do, and this is so uncontroversial that I'm going to say it first. Get on the FEMA website, see what they recommend that you do. Make sure that you do it. That's Federal Emergency Management Agency. They have checklists. They have things for you to buy. They have things you should practice doing. Do them.
Yeah, and I think when I've looked on that a couple years back, it's basically initial survival things. But let's take our caller. We got somebody on the air here that wants to have something to say or ask. Jackson, you're on the air.
Thanks for having me.
Certainly.
So I was wondering whether or not you think that this impending threat of nuclear holocaust could be classic problem reaction solution and could be used as an excuse to accelerate our progress towards a centralized power structure or a one world government?
Good question. Dimitri?
Well, in terms of how the one world government project is going, the U.S. was supposed to be part of that, right? So part of that plan was isolating Russia and bringing it down to heel and being tough on China and pushing China around, getting it to agree to everything. So how's that going? Isolating Russia, you know, there's a World Economic Forum going on right now in St. Petersburg, Russia. It's attended by heads of state from 60 different countries. The UN General Secretary is there. The head of the European Commission is there. Lots and lots of businessmen from all over the place interested in direct investment in Russia and starting joint projects, etc. The place is hopping. So as far as isolation, that didn't work right, did it? And so who would be running this world government, the Americans or the Russians, because they aren't running it together? And that's a question you'd have to answer first.
Well, and of course, after each war, each world war, we've created some body that governmental body, I should say, that whose purpose it was to unite the world more and to prevent future conflicts and an aggressive military behavior. And I think with this latest election of, and you can talk to this of Israeli. Members of the UN overseeing basically the rule of law. I think it talks to the more about the dysfunction of all these attempts at any kind of one world governments or understanding.
Well, actually, the UN has been strangely successful in a lot of ways. We have a few rogue actors The United States is the biggest one. The United States, for some reason, doesn't feel bound by international law and feels that it can impose U.S. law on the rest of the world, and that's not sitting well with the rest of the, you know, the planet. So there's a lot of pushback to that. But generally, it's, you know, it's creaky, but it's functional. As far as the whole human rights fiasco, yeah, the Saudis and the Israelis have recently been, you know, involved in UN human rights. That's a farce, and that's an indication of how the sort of Western model of human rights has collapsed because of human rights violations by the West itself and their refusal to come to terms with it. You know, the joke in Russia is that there's one remaining human right in the West, and that's the right of sexual minorities. All the other rights have been taken away. So there's really, you know, this is just sort of the Israeli and the Saudi involvement in that is just to accentuate the moral collapse of the West.
Let me remind our listeners one more time. You're listening to Unspun, an experiment in truth-telling. I'm your host, Doug Bennett. With us today is Dmitry Orlov, author, futurist, and blogger at Club Orlov. We are talking about our collapsing economic, political, environmental systems and the unipolar dominance theory. At least this is one held by many Americans in power, that somehow America can dominate the whole world. And that's one of the other sides of this conversation that we're having. And we can probably take one more phone call before the hour ends. So call in if you'd like, 337-1885, 337-1885. Well, our last caller, Jackson, talked about one world government, and I think that's an implication, too, about are any of our democracies actually functional, or is there really just a set of elites behind the shadow governments, behind our supposed or so-called democratic governments and institutions?
Well, you know, democracy works really well in small groups where you don't even have to have elections and you don't have to campaign and it's all fairly informal and based on everybody knowing everybody. So direct democracy is really good. Representative democracy is a big compromise. It's not very democratic to begin with because you have this class of representatives, which is above the people that they're supposed to represent. There's a great deal of confusion between representing somebody and governing them. Can't really do both at the same time because that's a conflict of interest. So then it goes downhill from there as you get to larger and larger groups. So by the time you get to an entity like the size of the United States with 300 million people, the sovereignty of the individual is so dilute that it becomes impossible to measure. So you can say that you make your voice heard by casting a vote. Well, prove it. Okay, do the statistics. Prove to me that your vote actually has the measurable effect on anything at all. I bet you won't be able to do it.
I would agree with you there. And we have in the studio with us is Willem McCarty, and he has a show here on KKR and Training Easy, and he sits in once in a while with me, and he has a question for you. So I'm going to bring Willie's mic up here. Willie, you're on the air.
Thank you. Thank you, Doug, and thank you for the show. So in your introduction, you were described as a futurist, and in listening to the show, I don't get much future in it. What do you see for us? What do you see? How are we going to get to a future if many of these scenarios are at least partially played out? Thank you.
Okay, well, what we were talking – thanks for the question. What we were talking about really is the present. And my emphasis recently has been in averting some kind of a nuclear catastrophe or an all-out war, which, given the insanity that is prevalent in the U.S. foreign policy circles and the fact that Hillary is part of that system and might actually get in, that is a non-zero probability. So we really need to try to do something about it. But as far as the future, we have runaway global warming. If you look at the charts, it's, warming has gone exponential. It has started to double. So we're not talking about 2 degrees Celsius warming. We're talking about 17. We're not talking about, a few meters sea level rise. We're talking about tens of meters. And so we're going to be living in a different world. I foresee that the human population will shrink to maybe 5, maybe 1% of the total that's alive today. Very sparse population, living more of a subsistence lifestyle. And so what we should be working on in terms of futurism is the transition. What sort of technologies will get us there? What types of social organizations will get us there and still allow us to survive and to preserve some of the culture that we want to keep?
So, and to answer Willie's question, of course, what you've already answered is the future is probably nothing, Willie, that you and I have ever seen or have a concept in our life of seeing. So we need to get prepared for the reckoning, in my mind. So any other comment, Willie, or thought before I shut your mic down?
Yes. Is there anything out there being prepared for that future, a future that is that I need to think about and think about going in that direction?
Okay.
Well, yes. I mean, there are lots of people who sometimes are called preppers. There are lots of people who are looking for ways of making that transition. When all of the life support systems, the industrial life support systems, suddenly fall away, because they do tend to fall away suddenly. And when that happens, most people are just left in the lurch because they haven't planned at all. They have no idea what to do. And then there's a minority of people who have prepared. And so if you want to be part of that, then there's an entire subculture you can join. To start with, you can do something that I already mentioned, which is perfectly straightforward. Go to the FEMA site, see what they recommend for your area in terms of preparation.
And the other thing you brought up, and what you name the rule of the 150, and you talked about that indirectly or directly, but not in those terms, which is something that you've done. Maybe you could talk to Willie about that, because we may end up, and probably will, in little enclaves of small groups of people that manage to get together and survive the whole thing.
Well, yes. We live right now in a society where everybody has some kind of a prescribed role. If either you provide a service or you're a customer, or a client, something like that, and it's all moderated by money, and we're all safeguarded, we're conditioned not to take the law into our own hands, but call 911. And when all of that falls away, we're left with who we know. So the important thing is to figure out who we know. And the cognitive maximum, or the number of people that we can have close relationships with, is about 150. Beyond that, it gets a little bit too remote to actually trust each other. But if you want to survive, you have to find out about 150 people who you know personally, who you trust, who will stand up for you, possibly even die for you, and you for them. And then you will be able to survive together, because a lone individual does not stand a chance.
Well, we have another caller, but unfortunately, we really don't have the time. We have less than 2 minutes. My last question for you, Dimitri, is, do you have room on your sailboat for a couple more of us?
Not really. It's a pretty small boat.
Well, if you want to. Yeah. Well, any last words for our listeners also, websites or something? You've got several great books. Maybe you could leave us with some references where we can pursue some of these ideas further.
Yes, if you go to my website, that's Club Orlov, ORLOV.blogspot.com. There are a couple of books that I've published, and I'm going to be continuing to publish them. I'm the editor and the publisher. It's a tiny publishing house, if you will. So there are some titles there. One is Bureaucratic Insanity, very interesting book, and the other one is 150 Strong. And so read those books, and they will clue you in on a lot of things that are seriously wrong in one case and things that could actually be fixed on the other.
Well, Dimitri, we're going to have in about 35, 40 seconds, you're going to hear some music. So I want to take this little spot in here to thank you very much for being on Unspun with us today. And you got a standing or seating ovation from Willie McCarty here in the studio. And I will, put links and everything to your work up on KKRN. But thank you for being on Unspun with us today.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Yes, on our side too. And now I'm going to have to sign off. So thanks for being with us, and bye-bye. Well, you've been listening to Unspun, an experiment in truth-telling. Our guest today has been Dimitri Orlov, author, futurist, and blogger at Club Orlov, blogspot.com, where you'll find his latest articles, links to his books, more. And as usual, I will put links to his works, as I was saying, along with the archives of this show at kkrn.org/shows/unspun. Starting next week, we're going into a vacation mode here on Unspun, and I'll be doing another series of the best of Unspun. So tune in and hear some of the most important voices of our time here on Unspun, an experiment in truth-telling, Saturday mornings, 9 a.m., and again Wednesday afternoons at 4 p.m. Next up, Tom Hartman on KKRN. Stay tuned. Thanks for listening.